Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, North Carolina's Runaway Train of Tax Credits. Corporations and individuals took more than $520 million in tax credits during fiscal 2015. That's the headline on the front page. The cover story article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. North Carolina's growing tax credit burden. More than 5,000 companies and individuals claimed $524 million in tax credits reserved for a variety of purposes such as creation of jobs, adding machinery, energy credits, and research and development. And this article is written by Amanda Hoyle. The gravy train of tax credits continues to fill up the coffers of corporations and individuals in North Carolina, despite the major changes to the state tax code in the past 2 years. While the new laws were able to eliminate a few corporate tax provisions, a Triangle Business Journal analysis of North Carolina Department of Revenue data reveals that companies and individuals are finding every possible provision to claim tax credits against their tax bills, even if some of the credit categories elapsed several years ago. In 2015 alone, more than 5,000 businesses and their investors in North Carolina claimed a total of $524 million in reductions on their corporate tax filings, a 31% increase over the $400 million in credit claims filed the year prior, and more than double the credits claimed statewide 5 years ago. All told, the credits have cost the state more than $1.8 billion over the past 5 years, and there's more coming. Credit claims in 2015 more than tripled on investments made in job creation and business property under the state's Article 3J tax law prior to its sunset at the end of 2013. Moreover, new qualifying investments in the past 3 years show another $567 million in probable 3J tax credit claims in future years. And while to many this may seem like a runaway corporate welfare provision, some of the state's most powerful economic developers believe the tax credits are worth it. Ernie Pearson, president of the North Carolina Economic Developers Association, which advocates on behalf of the economic development agencies and its professionals across the state, says the group still supports tax credits as an incentive tool, but the credits are lower on their legislative agenda for 2016. We still support tax credits, but our focus right now is trying to get the business facilities bill passed, says Pearson, in reference to HB 108 that would create a loan fund to help build new office, flex, and industrial buildings for prospective companies and job creators in areas of the state that have no available inventory. Expiring credits. State lawmakers, anticipating the potential increase of the provision in the last few sessions, decided to sunset several of the credit provisions. For example, tax credits geared toward investments in renewable energy projects and in research and development, two of the most widely used credits, expired as of January 1. Big corporations such as Bank of America and Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, as well as manufacturers like Lowe's Companies, Merck, and Novartis, are being advised to use it or lose it as the calendar days mark down to the end of the law's installment and carry forward periods. But claims under each of the laws will linger for a few years more, since the rules allow taxpayers to carry the credits over multiple years, a common practice among most states that use tax credits, says Ann Yancey, director of the State Credits and Incentives Group for the Cherry Bakert accounting firm. Renewable energy credits, for example, can be carried over for 5 years, while R&D credits in North Carolina can be carried over for 15 years. This is not an abuse of any kind by companies to take credits going forward. It is the law in all states, and it is actually beneficial to companies because every company cannot use the tax credits in their entirety in 1 year or even 2 years, Yancey adds. Most companies that I have seen have utilized their North Carolina credits and have little or no carry forward. Advocates of the laws argue that the growth in claims is a reflection on North Carolina's growing business economy. Only companies that are making taxable profits are eligible for claims, and taxpayers are allowed to only discount up to 50% of their total tax bill. Meg Wee, State Tax Policy Director for the Washington, D.C.-based Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, says if given a choice between reinstating North Carolina's corporate tax credit system or keeping the state's most recent cuts to the corporate income tax rate from 6% to 3% in 2017, she would go with the tax credits. The revenue gained from the eventual elimination of corporate tax credits pales in comparison to the revenue lost from the gradual cut in the corporate income tax rate, she says. Cracks in the structure. The tax credits, though, have not proven to be a very effective inducement to keep companies from moving jobs or expanding outside the state. Pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline in the past 3 years has claimed nearly $13 million in tax credits for research and development in North Carolina. But the drug maker in late 2014 announced it would be laying off 900 workers from its research and development groups in Research Triangle Park and transferring hundreds more researchers to a contract research organization. Miller Brewing Company claimed more than $4 million in credits over the last 3 years, mostly for purchases of new machinery and equipment, and in September announced it would be closing its brewery in Eden and letting go 520 employees. A June 2015 biennial report on corporate tax credits by the Commerce Department's Labor and Economic Analysis Division showed that the Article 3J credits for job creation were having some impact in the state's poor Tier 1 counties where credit qualifications are weighted heavier, but the majority of the new jobs were still going to the wealthier Tier 3 counties. In 2013 and 2014, the most recent data available, more than half of the total $76 million in job creation tax credits generated in those 2 years went to companies in Tier 1, countries that collectively created 3,713 new jobs. Companies in Tier 2 counties made claims on 4,092 jobs created, worth $20.9 million in tax credits. Tier 3 markets, that includes Wake, Durham, and Mecklenburg counties, had 9,205 jobs created with $9 million in tax credits claimed. Future strategy. But state leaders are also second-guessing the structure and functionality of the state's tier system. A December report by the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division has recommended eliminating the use of the Economic Development Tier System altogether. About 15 state agencies still use the tier structure, which uses a combination of factors such as unemployment, median household, population, and property value data to determine the communities that are in most need of available funds. North Carolina Commerce Secretary John Scavarla agrees with the assessment and has recommended shifting to an index scoring system for counties and communities that more accurately identify areas of distress. Moore County is a good example. It's a Tier 3 county with Pinehurst, but there are parts of Moore County that are still very poor, he says. I call it fine-tuning the dial, based on the nature of the program, to get the most positive effect rather than one-size-fits-all. Scavarla, who admits he's been a bit distracted by the questions that his department has been peppered with since the passing of the state's HB 2 transgender law in late March, says he also has higher priorities on his agenda for the department in 2016 than trying to spend time advocating for new corporate tax credits. He has instead been stumping for future support of the State Jobs Development Investment Grant and One North Carolina Fund programs, two discretionary funds that state recruiters can use to help lure new and expanding businesses. He's also been lobbying to legalize investment and crowdfunding measures in North Carolina as a way to help small business owners find new money to expand their businesses. Known as the North Carolina PACES Act, providing access to capital for entrepreneurs and small business, Scavarla says he'd rather the General Assembly approve changes to open up crowdfunding to more investors and establish a $100 million fund from resources in the state's ESHEETS fund to help small business owners expand their businesses. This isn't for innovation, he says. This would be a professionally managed fund that helps the everyday person start their business or grow their business. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by digital producer Mark DeRoberts. The main headline, Ambassador Judd lends time to yours charity. Golden Globe and Emmy-nominated actress Ashley Judd has been named this year's keynote speaker for the Evening of Hope, an annual charity dinner and auction benefiting the Foundation of Hope for research and treatment of mental illness. The event is on September 15 at the Angus Barn Pavilion in Raleigh. The restaurant's chef, Walter Royal, will prepare the dinner. Last year's event speaker was Zach Williams, son of the late actor Robin Williams. Judd is a board member for Population Services International, or PSI, and is an ambassador for the Washington, D.C.-based Youth AIDS Group. She recently was named Goodwill Ambassador by the United Nations Population Fund. The Raleigh-based Foundation of Hope was established in 1984 through Thad and Alice Ewer's commitment to find cures for mental illness. It is helmed by Executive Director Shelley Ewer Belk. Since 1985, the foundation has awarded 120 grants totaling more than $4.4 million for ongoing and new research and treatment, as well as for the development of researchers through UNC Chapel Hill and its affiliated program. That seed money has leveraged more than $140 million in National Institutes of Mental Health funds. Porsche for You, North Carolina Museum of Art raffling off 911 model. The North Carolina Museum of Art must still be fantasizing about its 2013 blockbuster exhibit that featured 22 rare Porsche models dating back to the 1930s. The museum's foundation board has launched a fundraising campaign to raffle off a 2016 Porsche 911 Carrera Cabriolet valued at more than $113,000. A museum official tells Biz that the Porsche is not a donation from a wealthy benevolent donor, but is being purchased wholesale from the Performance Porsche dealership in Durham. Raffle tickets are $100 apiece, and as of May 16, the museum had sold 1,742 chances at the car. Sales will be capped at 3,000 tickets, which means the museum will be able to get to net close to $190,000 if all the tickets are sold. Proceeds will go to support the Raleigh Museum's programming and events. Musician Newman all set to be honored at Moog Fest. One of the original pioneers of electronic music, Gary Newman, is the recipient of the 2016 Moog Innovation Award. The award, which will be presented to Newman at the Moog Pop-Up Factory on May 21 during Moog Fest's debut in Durham. Newman, whose career spans over 35 years with more than 50 releases, 23 top 40 singles, and 13 top 40 records, will join the ranks of other honorees inducted at Moog Fest, which include Brian Eno, Thomas Dolby, and Devo. Newman is best known for the 80s chart-topping hits Our Friends, Electric, Down by the Park, and Cars. He will be performing a three-night residency during Moog Fest starting on May 19th at the Motorco Music Hall in Durham. For kiteboarders and surfers, Poitras creates lager. The 2016 Wind Voyager Triple S Invitational is coming June 4 through June 10 at Real Water Sports in Cape Hatteras. This invitational features a lineup of talented kiteboarders who will compete alongside some of the best surfers in the world, and Chapel Hill's Carolina Brewery has made a beer for the occasion. The Vienna-style lager named Triple S Lager is made using German hops and malt and clocks in at just around 4.5% ABV. This marks the third year the brewery has made this beer, teaming up with the Triple S Invitational. We got involved in the Triple S Invitational from an idea I came up with while surfing at the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse, says Carolina Brewery's owner and founder, Robert Poitras. Along with Real Water Sports founder, Trip Foreman, they decided to craft a beer for the occasion back in 2014. Pinehurst area welcomes new 89-suite hotel. Hey golfers, you now have another option if you're going to the Pinehurst, Southern Pines, Aberdeen area and looking for a place to stay. Biz received a note from the folks at Marriott International that the long-awaited Town Place Suites in Aberdeen is now open for business. A quick look at the Marriott site shows room rates on weekdays and weekends can be anywhere from $129 to $160 a night. But General Manager Beth Thames is quick to point out that rates change from day to day. The 89-suite hotel is on 205 Columbus Drive in Aberdeen and will be managed by McPeak Hotels of Southern Pines. Because of its extended stay nature, the hotel will allow pets for a fee. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The main article, Inside the World's Largest Cash and Credit Machine Maker, Toshiba. Walk into just about any Walmart, Starbucks, Kohl's, or Kroger, and it's likely that the point of sale or cash machine at the checkout line will be branded with the Toshiba name and built with technology created at the company's headquarters in Research Triangle Park. Toshiba Global Commerce Solutions ranks as the largest installed point of sale system company in the world, according to analyst firm RBR, and employs more than 500 people at the company's headquarters in RTP and 3,000 people globally. On May 3, the company hosted an open house event at its newly renovated four-story office building in RTP, the building formerly known as Building 510 when it was owned and occupied by IBM. The event was a coming-out party of sorts for the company, created 4 years ago after Tokyo-based Toshiba Tech acquired the technology and assets of IBM's Retail Store Solutions Unit. The IBM Retail Unit had always been in RTP. It was where the inventors of the barcode perfected the technology behind the UPC, still used for scanning product labels in supermarkets and stores globally. While several of the most senior master inventors from IBM's retail division decided to take retirement rather than make the transition to the new company in 2012, Toshiba was able to hang on to many of its master inventors. Collectively, the group has hundreds of patent filings on record with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office for the pieces and parts that help keep Toshiba ahead of the competition in the retail market for point-of-sale systems. But the retail market is changing, and changing fast. Online commerce is forcing retailers to become more sophisticated with how they sell and market to customers, and Toshiba's hardware and software design teams have been tasked with staying ahead of the curve. In RTP, Toshiba has created a showroom floor of its latest technologies, including the latest generations of touchscreen monitor systems and mobile applications that allow customers to scan their items as they go. The company is also testing a system that can scan a whole grocery basket and calculate the price total instantaneously, while at the same time using facial recognition software to apply any special coupons or discounts for which that customer may qualify. The top 1% of retail we're fortunate to have as customers, says Scott McAbee, a California-based executive who was appointed the new president and CEO of Toshiba GCS in August. But it's a rapidly changing marketplace, he says. Agri-Hood project in Durham has builder, but still needs money. The development team behind the proposed Wet Rock Farm neighborhood development in North Durham, the region's first Agri-Hood project, has run into some snags getting the final bit of financing it needs to get started. The project already has reservations for all 141 housing lots planned for the 230-acre site near Treyburn, but developer Rick Bagel says they still need to raise up to $3 million more to break ground. The group launched a new crowdsourcing funding initiative through Chicago-based Peer Realty to sell equity interest in the project to accredited investors, and Bagel is also seeking an additional development partner to help get it off the ground. Wet Rock Resources has already secured letters of intent from four Triangle Area home building companies who have committed to buying all of the lots at Wet Rock Farm once site development is complete. The builder lineup includes B. Wallace Design and Construction of Durham, Thayer Custom Homes of Raleigh, Hartridge Builders of Chapel Hill, and Pegasus Land Company of Durham. 10,000-plus homes on slate for the area, highest since 2008. New home construction starts in the Triangle hit a milestone in the first quarter, exceeding 10,000 annualized units for the first time since 2008. New home starts counted from the previous 12 months hit 10,437 units, a 22% increase from the number of annualized starts the year prior. A clear indicator, says Jay Colvin, director of Metro Studies Raleigh-Durham Triangle Region, that the Triangle home builder market is back to normal. Homes in more moderate price points, in general below $300,000, are still undersupplied and remain in high demand, he says. This is critical because many home builder revenues have grown predominantly from building and marketing in the above $300,000 market. Undersupply of homes or lack of lots is no longer an issue, in most instances, for homes priced above $300,000. New $62 million hotel at Duke University to honor creator of Duke Endowment. In the midst of the ongoing expansion of Duke University's Thomas Executive Conference Center, the university has announced it will open a new $62 million hotel named in honor of J.B. Duke, creator of the Duke Endowment. The J.B. Duke Hotel will be located near the Fuqua School of Business program on Duke's West Campus in Durham. It replaces the previous hotel accommodations that the school had been hosting before, used mostly for visiting executives in the Fuqua School training and education programs. The new 7-story full-service hotel will have 198 guest rooms, access to 20,850 square feet of meeting, classroom, and event space, including a 5,450 square foot ballroom, an in-house restaurant, and 2 bars. It's expected to open in January 2017. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page, written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline: big money backs RTP's first biopharma accelerator. AgTech Group starts with $11.5 million. A new startup accelerator focused on emerging agricultural technologies has launched with $11.5 million in backing from major players in the Triangle's life sciences industry. Called AgTech Accelerator, the group has backing from companies such as Bayer and Syngenta, and investment groups including Hatteras Venture Partners and Pappas Capital. Its goal is to identify and grow the next generation of innovative agriculture companies. Alexandria Real Estate Equities is the lead investor in the accelerator that will be based in RTP. As recently as two decades ago, a lot of early-stage drug discovery and development happened within big pharmaceutical companies, but that work shifted to smaller companies that spun out of academia. A similar shift is now happening in agriculture, where a lot of the early work still takes place in one of 6 big companies, including Monsanto and DuPont. While biotechnology and medical devices and equipment companies raised more than $10 billion in 2015, according to PricewaterhouseCoopers, agricultural technology companies raised just $2.36 billion in 2014 and $4.6 billion in 2015, according to AgFunder, a conduit between investors and agricultural companies, which adds that the 2015 figure was higher than expected. The tectonic plates within ag are shifting, says John Dombrowski, the group's director who left Syngenta, another of the big 6, to start the AgTech Accelerator behind the scenes 9 months ago. Already, the accelerator has collaborative agreements in place with 7 universities, including NC State, Duke University, and UNC Chapel Hill, and other land-grant universities around the nation. By leveraging the institution's brand and deep expertise in developing basic science, engineering, life science, and agricultural science innovations, AgTech Accelerator companies will access and integrate novel technology, research, incubation, and product development capabilities, according to the AgTech announcement. Make no mistake, the accelerator intends to see a return on its investments. After all, the group will take an equity stake and, as Dombrowski says, we are unabashed capitalists. In a section called Biotech Happenings, Fujifilm opens new 62,000 square foot facility to house three science units. Morrisville's Fujifilm Diosynth Biotechnologies opened its new three-story, 62,000 square foot facility in Research Triangle Park. The new building, called Bioprocess Innovation Center, and located at 6051 George Watts Hill Drive, houses the company's process and analytical research and development, process sciences, and stability groups. As a contract development and manufacturing organization, CDMO, the company helps life sciences companies develop and manufacture their products. Troubles for Durham drug developer Heat Biologics continued when NASDAQ notified the company it could see its shares delisted from the stock exchange. Already, Heat cut its workforce by 22%, cut compensation for the remaining leadership team, and reduced planned enrollment for a drug trial in order to reduce costs. The company has said that without raising additional capital, it will not have enough cash to fund operations into next year. In March 2013, the company debuted on the NASDAQ exchange with an initial public offering at $10 per share. Investors have lost confidence in the company, however, and shares dip below $1 for 30 consecutive business days. And in a section called Big Numbers, 456 layoffs announced by Arrow International, a subsidiary of Morrisville-based Teleflex Incorporated in Asheboro, $150 million in shares that Chapel Hill drug developer Sempra shelved. Sempra could sell some or even none of those shares, but has registered them if it wants to raise capital. 20% share price pop in the morning of May 9 of Durham drug developer Chimerix after it released a press release about drug trial results. And 5% share price loss on the day for Chimerix after investors read more deeply into the actual trial results. And finally, in the section called He Said It, the quote, "We recognize that the sales trajectory for Bunavail has not yielded results at the level we anticipated. We are strategically consolidating the sales force to focus our efforts on our most productive territories and returning our marketing spend." And that's from Mark Sergo, BioDelivery Sciences International CEO, in announcing the company would switch from a contract sales force to a smaller sales team of direct employees. The decision followed sluggish sales of Bunavail, the BioDelivery painkiller marketed specifically as having a lower likelihood of abuse. And now we turn to the On Technology page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, First Citizens buys Pennsylvania Bank's assets. Raleigh's First Citizens Bank just purchased certain assets of troubled Pennsylvania institution First Cornerstone Bank. The Pennsylvania Department of Banking and Securities had just closed the bank, appointing FDIC as the receiver. And through a competitive bidding process, First Citizens, run by Frank Holding Jr., which already has more than 550 branches in 20 states, was able to reach a deal with the FDIC. It's a common move for First Citizens, which has secured two FDIC-related agreements this year. Here's a look at its recent FDIC-related deals. May 2016, First Cornerstone Bank, which had a total of $103.3 million in assets, the deal included six branches. March 2016, North Milwaukee State Bank, which had a total of $67.1 million in assets, the deal included two branches. February 2015, Capital City Bank and Trust Company, which had a total of $275 million in assets, the deal included eight branches. July 2011, Colorado Capital Bank, which had a total of $717.5 million in assets, the deal included seven branches. January 2011, United Western Bank, which had a total of $2.1 billion in assets, the deal included eight branches. And the article continues going back to September of 2009 on the various deals that they've had. NC State researcher looks to change economics of RFID technology. Research that could completely revolutionize the RFID tag, a technology already used in everything from parking passes to retail price tags, could soon spin out of NC State University. Researchers say they figured out a way to drastically reduce the cost of the technology, and they're looking for commercialization opportunities. Paul Franzon, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at NCSU and senior author of a paper on the research, says some of the major players in the RFID arena have already reached out to talk about potential partnerships. "We're testing it right now, and frankly, once we have the test results, we'll market it more aggressively," he said in an interview May 9. The devices he's testing are 25% smaller than traditional RFIDs, meaning cheaper, more efficient devices. RFID tags, the very technology that communicates to a traffic barrier to lift when you wave your parking pass in front of the scanner, typically work with a reader transmitting a radio signal. That signal is picked up by the RFID tag, which converts the AC of the radio signal into DC in order to power internal circuits, which then control the signal that is bounced back to the reader. Franzen and team think they've been able to eliminate the hardware used to convert the AC signal to DC entirely by developing RFID circuits that directly operate off of AC power. "RFID is a very cost-sensitive market," he says. "Anything that reduces the cost of making the chip is valuable." Southern Company signs docs to complete deal. Georgia utility giant Southern Company has officially closed on its buy of Wake Forest utility management technology firm PowerSecure. That means PowerSecure, which ceased trading on the New York Stock Exchange May 9, is now a wholly owned subsidiary of Southern Company. Thomas Fanning, CEO of Southern Company, said that his team is thrilled to draw on PowerSecure's nationally recognized expertise. Under the deal terms, PowerSecure shareholders received $18.75 in cash in exchange for each share of common stock, a total purchase price of about $425 million. RDU Airport getting busier as summer approaches. Business was booming at Raleigh-Durham International Airport in March, with the average daily departure count increasing by nearly 8%. That's according to recently released year-over-year figures, which put the average number of daily departures at 191, a 7.8% uptick from the 177 reported in March of 2015. So far, the average daily departure number in 2016 has been 180, compared to 169 during the same time in 2015. The airport saw a total of 435,745 in-plane passengers, compared with 396,572 same time last year. So far this year, the airport has seen a total of 1,123,061 in-plane passengers, a 9.2% increase from the 1,028,038 passengers in 2015, same period. And in other news in the Triangle Business Journal, G1 Therapeutics nabs $47 million from prominent investors. This article is written by Jason DeBruin. G1 Therapeutics, a UNC Chapel Hill spinout developing cancer treatments, raised $47 million from private investors. This fundraiser comes on the back of $33 million raised in 2015 and $12.5 million raised in 2014. Investors include local venture capital groups such as Hatteras Venture Partners and Eshelman Ventures. However, in the latest round, G1 disclosed that total investors had doubled from 10 to 20 groups and included new investors Aju 1B Investment, Cowan Private Investments, Franklin Templeton Investments, and Rock Springs Capital. What stands G1 apart from other drug developers is that it is developing a way to protect bone marrow during chemotherapy treatments. When treating cancer, chemotherapy will kill a tumor, but often will also kill many of the healthy cells in the body. If the G1 treatment can successfully protect healthy cells in a cancer patient, it could become a breakthrough in cancer treatments. G1 is led by Mark Valleca, who came to the company in 2014 after a career that included stops at other life sciences startups, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, and Yale University School of Medicine. G1's lead product candidate, G1-T28, is being developed as a first-line combination treatment for small cell lung cancer, SCLC. In April, G1 presented preliminary clinical trial data from G1-T28 at the 2016 American Association for Cancer Research, or AACR, annual meeting. The additional funds will fund continued development of the lead candidate, of a second drug, G1-T38, and to expand its pipeline in other oncology indications. G1 plans to use the proceeds to advance the clinical development of its lead CDK4/6 inhibitors, G1-T28 and G1-T38, and to expand its pipeline in multiple oncology indications. We are encouraged by the enthusiasm of our new and existing investors in the potential of our drug candidates to be first and best-in-class therapeutics across multiple oncology indications, said Valleca. We look forward to advancing our lead therapies through early and mid-stage clinical studies and expanding our pipeline to address significant unmet needs in people with cancer. Now we turn to the Executive Voice question and answer column that focuses on Chuck Purvis, President and CEO of Coastal Federal Credit Union. The headline, "He is ready to let the secret out. Coastal Federal Credit Union CEO goes personal, talks business traits." And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. Coastal Federal Credit Union President and CEO Chuck Purvis calls his credit union one of the Triangle's best-kept secrets. And by slapping the Coastal name on what used to be called Walnut Creek Amphitheater, he's trying to change that. That's because his Raleigh business, like other small financial institutions, can't rely on legacy customers. The millennials are here, and they're already changing banking forever, he says. Coastal's goal isn't just to keep up, it's to stand out. And Purvis, a Raleigh businessman with decades of experience in the credit union industry, is counting on technology to help shine the spotlight on Coastal. Via a Q&A, he shares his advice and tips. What did you want to be when you grew up? A basketball player. I loved the team and competitive aspect of the sport, usually played 5 to 6 days a week, often with much older players. I was the short and fast kid on the court. How did you get into the world of banking, credit unions? Being in the right place at the right time. I took a job with the State Trade Association for Credit Unions in Greensboro soon after Congress deregulated interest rates. I spent a number of years using an Apple II computer and VisiCalc, first spreadsheet software, building financial models for credit unions. And 34 years later, I'm still working in the industry. What was your first job and what did it teach you? Mowing yards in my neighborhood during the summer. It taught me about working hard and honoring commitments, even when I'd rather be doing something else. Who were your mentors growing up? My parents. Neither had a college degree, and both worked hard to create a middle-class lifestyle for our family. Dad always worked in sales, and Mom was a secretary. They worked hard to provide a safe, caring environment for their three kids. What book should every CEO read? The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown by Paul Taylor. The book applies a generational lens to how America is changing rapidly, explains a lot of our current and future debates over income inequality, immigration, and marriage, among other things, a must-read for business leaders. What's the biggest misconception people have about credit unions? That it's an exclusive club that is hard to join. Over 1,400 employers and associations have asked us to make membership available to their employees and their family members. Because we have federal in our name, many assume you have to be a federal employee to join. Not true. We rarely have difficulty finding a way for consumers in the Triangle to join Coastal. What's your favorite way to spend a weekend in the Triangle? In the Triangle, that would be attending a concert at the newly named Coastal Credit Union Music Park at Walnut Creek, a great venue with great concerts. We also spend many weekends at our lake house on Hyco Lake, the best-kept secret in North Carolina. If you're not familiar with that lake, it's right outside of Roxborough. That's still in the Triangle, isn't it? What's your go-to vacation spot? Anywhere our sons and grandson can spend a week with us, usually at one of the North Carolina beaches or at our lake house. What advice do you have for May University grads? Be very open-minded about industries and careers you will consider. I did not come out of college with the goal of getting into credit unions or banking. That opportunity just presented itself, and I took advantage of it. Be willing to start in roles you may feel are beneath you, and understand that a career is a marathon, not a sprint. You'll be working for 30 to 40 years, so patience matters. What qualities, other than resume bullet points, does Coastal look for in its employees? We are fundamentally in the service business. Our products are financial in nature, but our members come to us to have problems solved or to make dreams come true. So the key qualities we look for are problem-solving skills, member or customer service skills, and great listening and empathy skills. Everybody at Coastal is either serving a member or serving another employee who is. We compete against the biggest financial institutions in America. We will win or lose based on how well we solve problems and serve our members. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page. And first on the Viewpoint page, we read the column written by Katie Culp, who is president of KSM Location Advisors. She has consulted and advised clients about economic development incentives, location analysis, and related economic development opportunities on more than 400 projects in all 48 contiguous states. The headline, Let's Talk HB2 Beyond the Anecdotal Evidence. In the political arena, there is an adage, when you are explaining, you are losing. North Carolina, which has consistently been named one of the top five business-friendly states in the country, finds itself in the awkward position of explaining itself. Businesses have traditionally been drawn to North Carolina because of the educated, talented workforce, the cost of doing business, and the energy around the state's banking, life sciences, and emerging tech scenes. Now the bathroom bill, or HB2, has become an unfortunate part of the state's narrative and has caused North Carolina to explain itself instead of focusing on its many positive attributes. I've recently worked with more than a dozen companies in North Carolina on economic development and location advising, including one of the largest privately held pharmaceutical companies in the U.S. and a Fortune 500 medical device company. I've also worked extensively in both rural and urban communities in North Carolina. And I can tell you this, HB2 has become an unfortunate part of the state's compelling narrative. Lionsgate, PayPal, and Deutsche Bank are just a few of the national names who have pulled projects in North Carolina in the past few months, specifically pointing to passage of HB2. Time Warner Cable News estimates a loss of more than 1,750 jobs and more than $77 million worth of investments and visitor spending because of it. But do jobs really flee states when perceived discriminatory legislation is passed? Two examples in other states point to possible answers. Years ago, Arizona was called a haven for intolerance because of the state's failure to pass a law establishing a state holiday honoring slain civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. After failing to pass in 1990, the measure succeeded 2 years later. In the meantime, the measure cost the state the 1993 Super Bowl, among other events, and cost the state more than $100 million in anticipated revenue. More recently, in 2015, the Indiana State Legislature passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA, The Center for American Progress found that the measure cost or put at risk more than $250 million in revenue to the state. An amendment to the bill was put in place quickly, but a subsequent study in early 2016 from Visit Indy, the city's tourism arm, still pegged the number at $60 million in hotel bookings and lost convention business. Employers' generally favorable impression of North Carolina has been replaced with a question mark, and other states are swooping in to take advantage. I've seen firsthand that neighboring states and distant ones are being aggressive in their recruiting efforts to companies that had been strongly considering North Carolina as a home or a site to expand. Indiana faced a similar onslaught last year in response to RFRA. Forceful efforts have been made and will continue to woo uncertain parties. I've heard some officials defend HB 2, explaining that the exact language is not actually so harmful. While that response could be the topic of its own article, my point here is that the perception issue transcends semantics. Most key decision makers will never read the bill, but the bill's impression will leave a lasting legacy. Further, cities, also crucial economic development engines, are directly impacted by states' legislation. Even communities like Durham that have passed ordinances disavowing the statewide law will face consequences from the state's actions. And the fallout could continue. Just last week, the NCAA announced that it would ban states and localities from hosting NCAA events if they don't provide anti-discrimination protections based on sexual orientation and sexual identity. The NCAA Board of Commissioners didn't point to North Carolina specifically, but declared that the action was directed at recent actions of legislature in several states to enact legislation that limits protections on the LGBT community. Unfortunately, the legislation has tarnished what was once a sterling national reputation for economic development. The track record of states injecting themselves in social issues generally results in strong consequences and unwanted national attention, with jobs and revenue the casualties. And the other Viewpoint article is written by Al Krockman, who is a partner in the Public Contracts Practice Group at Blank Rome LLP in Washington, D.C. The headline on his Viewpoint column, The Sobering Lessons of Tech's Section 508. The Department of Justice's dismissal of its reverse encryption suit against Apple marks the start, not the end, of a public-private negotiation on the accessibility of information. But few recall that we have seen this movie before, albeit in a slightly different form. About 18 years ago, some sectors of the tech industry questioned the Fed's mandate to force manufacturers to make technology accessible to disabled individuals. The accessibility law, which became known as Section 508, appeared to subject the electronic and information technology, EIT, industry to several burdensome compliance requirements to make EIT accessible to the disabled. Federal contracts were on the leading edge of imposing these requirements on federal vendors. There are parallels between Section 508 and the current encryption debate. Both involve the intersection of social policy and technology. Both also involve different forms of accessibility. 508 concerned accessibility of EIT by persons with disabilities, while the encryption debate is about government's accessibility to private information on EIT. Both also involve compliance with some forms of technical standards that balance the interests of different constituencies. The manner by which the Section 508 standards were developed should be instructive for today's EIT encryption debate. For Section 508, the federal government created a Section 508 Standards Board. Over an extended time period, the Standards Board solicited and received input from stakeholders and other interested parties. The input shaped the eventual approved standards. As with 508, the government could establish a technical standards board that studies all sides of the encryption debate. Like 508, the public could be solicited for input, and the board could be charged with considering the many legal, technical, and security issues surrounding the debate and craft encryption standards and protocols. That is far preferable than the government's making Ad Hoc demands that technology companies break their own encryption to search for leads in criminal investigations. The government should create a policy describing what information it's entitled to when. And it should create that policy through an open political process. A start may be in the recent proposal by House Homeland Security Committee Chairman Michael McCaul, Republican of Texas, and Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, to create a national commission on security and technology challenges in the digital age. Like the Section 508 Standards Board, the commission would develop viable recommendations on how to balance competing digital security priorities. And now we turn to the People on the Move section of the Triangle Business Journal. The spotlight is on Martin Kelleher, COO, CFO of Brooks Bell. Former finance chief of Monster.com North America and online executive at Sears, Martin Kelleher has been tapped to lead the day-to-day operations and financial responsibilities of Brooks Bell, a Raleigh-based online optimization and testing firm. As chief operating officer and chief financial officer of the firm, Kelleher is responsible for expanding and overseeing sales, marketing, legal, human resources, and finance functions of the business. Brooks Bell currently employs more than 40 people and is on track to be at 50 by the end of the year, Kelleher says. The majority of those employees are based in the Triangle. Brooks Bell was founded in 2003 and is helmed by its founder, CEO, and namesake, Brooks Bell. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? I empower teams. They have the answers and I help unleash their energy. What are some of your major goals for your new position? To listen and learn from my teammates and our clients. To empower the organization through improved processes, tools, and systems. And have lots of fun. I believe if you don't have a sense of humor, you have no sense. Biggest worry? That I'm achieving my full potential. Biggest pet peeve? Being late for anything gets me going, but I'm trying to learn the laid-back ways of North Carolina. Triangle area business person you most admire? I have to say that our founder and CEO, Brooks Bell, is someone who I've gotten to know and feel she's accomplished a lot in a fairly short period. Education, Bachelor's of Commerce from University College Cork in Ireland, qualified as an accountant in the UK, MBA from Duke University. Personal, wife Jillian, two sons, Connor and Kevin. Last book you've read? Capitalism and Slobalization by Ajed Bacas. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read from the list in the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, How Safe Is Your Hospital? Nearly half of North Carolina's hospitals received a stellar grade for patient safety, a percentage that ranks this state 10th in the nation. The grades come from LeapFrog Group's Spring 2016 Hospital Safety Score. In the Triangle area, six hospitals received an A in the latest ranking. In fact, Duke Raleigh Hospital, Duke Regional Hospital, Duke University Hospital, and UNC Rex Hospital have received straight A grades since LeapFrog Group began its national hospital scorecard 3 years ago. Generally, the Triangle has received a higher percentage of A grades than similarly sized cities. LeapFrog Group did not issue a safety score for every hospital. Many hospitals are not able to provide data to the federal government because they are too small or for other reasons. Military and veterans hospitals are not issued a hospital safety score due to lack of available data. Adequate information is sometimes not available to issue a fair safety score for every hospital. Certain hospitals are exempt from the requirement to publicly report on safety. The scores are calculated using 28 measures, which are all publicly available by hospital safety figures. The hospital safety score signifies the overall capacity to keep patients safe from preventable harm. Receiving an A were Duke Raleigh Hospital, Duke University Hospital, Duke Regional Hospital, UNC Rex Healthcare, WakeMed Carey Hospital, and Johnston Health. Receiving a B, WakeMed Raleigh Campus, Betsy Johnson Regional Hospital, Central Carolina Hospital, receiving a C, UNC Hospitals, Granville Medical Center, First Health Moore Regional Hospital, Person Memorial Hospital, and receiving a D, Maria Parham Medical Center. And we'll read as much as we can from the small business column written by Jim Lee, who is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. The headline, Coping with the Scariest Nightmares for Family Businesses. If you run a business, if you have the buck stops here responsibility for seeing that the shareholders and stakeholders get their expectations met, the odds are better than even that you don't sleep soundly every night. There are always a few nightmares prancing around at the edge of your dreams. When those shareholders and stakeholders are members of your own family, the nightmares can become real terrors. Here are five of the scariest nightmares that haunt the sleep and help explain the choices of people who run family-owned businesses. 1. Having to fire a family member. 2. Having to tell the family that the business is going under. 3. Inviting a qualified young family member to come into the business and being turned down cold. 4. Having to choose between respecting the family patriarch or matriarch and taking action to save the family business. And 5. Handing over control of the business, which is the sole source of your retirement income, to your son or daughter, and then watching the whole enterprise sink right into the ground. This nightmare, perhaps more than any other single factor, can compel a senior owner to hang on to the reins of authority long after he, the rest of the family, and the business itself are ready for a change. A fully funded retirement plan would relieve this headache, of course, but too many family businesses still rely on cash flow for the upkeep of their elder statespersons. For those senior owners, the collapse of the company would be a bigger disaster than the collapse of Social Security. With that specter before them, they understandably prefer to hang on to a steady paycheck instead of putting their futures into uncertain hands. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for this episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.